You're listening to The West Wing Weekly. I'm Hrishikesh Hirway.
And I'm Joshua Molina.
Today, we're talking about Season 1, Episode 18, Six Meetings Before Lunch.
It aired originally on April 5th, 2000. It was written by Aaron Sorkin and directed by Clark Johnson.
All right, let me give a little synopsis here.
I'm excited. This is a new Rishi synopsis.
Mm-hmm.
Now, be honest, you pre-wrote this or you're freestyling?
No, I'm freestyling right now.
Wow, brave.
In this episode, Zoe goes to a frat party and her friend is arrested for drug use. They think he's a drug dealer. And CJ has to deal with trying to keep it out of the press. The confirmation of Judge Mendoza, now Justice Mendoza, finally comes through. And Josh has to talk to a civil rights lawyer about statements he made about reparations. Sam has his flirty debate with Mallory about school vouchers. And Mandy tries to get Toby to help her get some pandas for the National Zoo.
That was a remarkable live performance. I applaud you.
Thank you.
Well done.
So it's called Six Meetings Before Lunch.
What are the six meetings?
What are the six meetings?
Yeah, I don't have the diligence that you have because you probably tried to count through. Somewhere in there, my eyes glazed over and I thought, I can only think of two meetings that are happening. I know Sam and Mallory meet.
Mm-hmm.
And they meet cute and they have their little official work time flirtation slash argument slash conversation.
Six meet cutes before lunch sounds like a Katherine Heigl movie.
Yes, it does.
I mean, this is the thing. What are you going to count as a meeting? Is it when somebody makes an appointment and then they have to go see that person? There's either fewer than six or way more than six. Because CJ alone meets with Zoe, Danny, Gina Toscano, Sam, and the president. That's just CJ's day.
That's five. If you could come up with just one more, we can maintain the titles about CJ.
Yeah, that's it. That's all I got.
I think she had one more off-screen meeting.
Right.
Hence the six meetings before lunch.
Yep. But then you've got Mallory and Sam, Josh and Jeff Breckenridge, the lawyer, and Mandy and Toby. I don't know. It doesn't add up. I was wondering where that six meetings before lunch title comes from. If somebody has an accurate count.
I was going to say, that's the kind of thing, why think through it ourselves? Throw it to the viewers, there'll be 19 responses within 5 minutes of the podcast going out.
All with different math.
Yeah. I was mainly, forget about the number of meetings, I just wanted to see lunch. I wanted to know what they were serving.
So we start this episode with the confirmation, or what might be the confirmation of Mendoza.
Well, it seems to be what everyone in the White House, everyone on the White House staff takes it to be the slam dunk roll call to confirm Mendoza, and we find a dour Toby insisting that no champagne be popped, no drinks be poured before the 51st yay is called out on the floor. He's a little superstitious, is Toby Ziegler.
51 yay votes is what we see on these screens before a drop of wine is swallowed. Because there's a little thing called what, Bonnie?
Tempting fate.
Tempting fate is what it's called.
And I applaud his superstition.
You don't like popping champagne early?
No, I hate being superstitious, but I also can't help it.
Yeah. I've got all sorts of that stuff, too. I do a lot of poo-poo. You know what poo-poo is?
I'm sure. It's one of our sponsors.
Oh, that's a good point. That is almost too on the nose. There's a Jewish thing where if you mention anything good, like were you to say, Judge Mendoza is going to be confirmed as an associate justice of the Supreme Court today, somebody would immediately say, poo-poo. You either say that or you actually spit.
Mm.
And my understanding is you ward off the evil eye. Anything you mention something good that's happening or appears to be happening, you then have to just create something bad that happened. You just spit or you say poo-poo. And it's like, okay, that bad thing happened. So now the good thing isn't not going to happen.
It's like knocking on wood.
It is, right. I think knocking on wood refers back to knocking on a cross. So the Jews had to come up with their version, and for some reason they said, well, just spit. Just spit or say poo-poo.
There's a thing that my mom does, and other Indian aunties, all Indian women who are your mom's age or so, you know, give or take 20 years, they're all aunties. So when they're trying to ward off the evil eye, they do a thing. It's specifically if someone's going to like cast an evil eye on someone to protect them, they do this thing where they put their hands against your face, and then it's actually really gentle and quite affectionate. They crack their knuckles on the side of your head.
Ooh, I've never heard of that one. I like it.
It's really, I used to love it so much, I would ask my mom to do it.
And any idea what the thinking behind that is?
I'm not sure what the thinking was, but you know, when I was 7, I thought it was fantastic.
Is there any vestige? Because I will now, as a middle-aged Jew myself, say I say poo-poo all the time. Oh, call me, you know, when your plane lands safely, poo-poo, give me a call.
Okay. You say that.
Yeah, sure, my kids love that.
Well, my mom still does it to me every now and then.
Oh, there you go.
So there's that.
Do you have any superstitious stuff?
I have so many. I am plagued by superstition.
So give me, let's toss something out.
Oh, they aren't like codified real superstitions. They are things where I'm like, oh, I did well on this math test by sitting in this chair, therefore I must sit in that chair again. That kind of dumb stuff.
Yeah. No, well, we got a little bit of that from Dulay. You know, the first audition went well. I better wear the same clothes.
Right. But there was at least some reasoning in that, right? They liked you in those clothes. So
I guess you're right. There's at least a modicum of sense to that.
Yeah. There are all kinds of weird Indian ones that my parents have foisted on me. And now I take it back. There are some prescribed ones, like if you sneeze just before you leave the house, you're not supposed to go. You're not supposed to leave right away. You're supposed to like sort of recollect or something like that. So many of these, I don't even know what the real deal is. I just do them.
Interesting.
And I'm universal. You want to throw a superstition at me? I'll be like, yeah, there's probably something to it. And I'll do that.
Well, I'll know that I finally had an effect on you when I hear you say, I had a good meeting today, poo-poo.
All right.
That will absolutely make my day if that should ever occur. But it has to be natural. It has to be organic.
Josh, I think your colonoscopy is going to go great. Poo-poo.
Wow. Again, 2 on the nose. All right. In any event, Toby's a little superstitious, but as soon as the 51st yay is heard, the champagne flows.
Yeah.
And they have a little party.
Before they even pop the champagne, Bonnie and Ginger do such a great job of both humoring him and also looking like they're suffering under him.
Yeah, that's true.
And I love when Josh finally enters. First of all, his Toby, as he walks in.
Toby!
Joshua, want some champagne?
No.
What the hell?
Ginger.
Tempting fate.
Okay.
We also get a telladonna here between Leo and Margaret.
As to what? Refresh my memory.
Margaret doesn't know what reparations are.
Oh, I don't remember that moment.
What was that?
An appointment to a justice post favors reparations to African Americans.
What for?
Capturing their ancestors and keeping them as slaves.
What kind of reparation?
Money.
Oh, yeah, that this is rough. So Margaret, not a U.S. history major.
I guess not. This is one where I didn't know what the difference is between 2000 and 2016. I mean, in 2016, we are living in an age past Ta-Nehisi Coates and the case for reparations, which I felt like was a pretty big deal and ended up winning him a lot of awards and got a lot of attention.
This is the article in The Atlantic?
That's right, his article in The Atlantic.
I was thinking that this episode doesn't dig too deep into anything too political, but it gets closest on reparations and the conversation between Breckinridge and Josh Lyman. And so we might at least link to that article, which is an incredibly well-written and I think pretty persuasive argument for reparations.
In the episode, there's a book coming out. It's called The Unpaid Debt by Otis Hastings.
That Breckinridge has blurbed.
But as that is not a real book, we'd recommend that you guys go to The Atlantic and we'll have a link to read The Case for Reparations by Ta-Nehisi Coates. Even before that, I certainly knew about what reparations were. I think my first introduction to it might have come from Spike Lee, because his production company was called 40 Acres and a Mule.
Yes.
Which they explain the 40 Acres and a Mule in this episode.
They do reference. Yeah.
But so even whenever Do the Right Thing came out, sometime in the early 90s, I was like, oh, okay. And that was kind of where I...
Yeah. Well, I also, as a young Jewish boy, I was also aware of the concept...
Of course.
...of massive societal wrongs being redressed in some way financially and, you know, reparations from Germany for Holocaust victims is a real thing. And Israel has received payments from the German government. It was, I think, probably a significant part of German society also starting to come to terms in a very real way with what had happened. And it's also, there are ongoing attempts to get people's looted houses and money and bank accounts and property and art restored to them even today. So I've always been sensitive to and, you know, aware of the argument for reparations.
Yeah. So this telladonna to me felt too expository.
Well, you know what? It's interesting. I'm glad that you brought it up because it speaks to me. There's a recurring issue I have with moments in the West Wing where I can both appreciate their inclusion in the show and yet I feel talked down to at times. There are often moments, and sometimes it's a greater issue, but there are times where I think to myself, there are probably people who needed to hear that. But for me as a viewer, I feel a little bit condescended to because I feel like someone's saying, hey, you probably don't know what this is, but it's this.
I totally get what you're saying.
It gets my back up a little bit, but at the same time, I'm thinking, well, maybe this is good because there's probably also a 14-year-old kid watching this who's maybe going to say, oh, yeah, oh, that's what that is. And maybe they're going to go Google it and they're going to learn more. So the ongoing civics lesson that is the West Wing also has great value. But sometimes it does work as a little bit of a hiccup in the flow or dramatic movement of an episode.
No, that's true. And it's completely subjective because there are obviously things that other people might find blatantly obvious that for me, I was informed or educated or my mind was changed because of something that happened on the show. And someone else would be like, you didn't already know about that? So this just happens to be, you could pick and choose those moments.
Yeah, that's true.
I have no problem with the moments where the West Wing goes broad in order to get as many people to watch and be involved as possible, because that's only about 10% of the time. And the other 90%, it feels like it's just for me. And if that 10% is what it takes in order to keep the show going and get all the money that it needs, let's do it.
Yeah, well said. Fair enough.
I think that the Josh and Breckenridge debate is so fantastic. Despite what I said about this introduction between Leo and Margaret, the way they handle that is everything that I want from the West Wing. I feel like with both that meeting and with the Sam and Mallory meeting, even though in that case the stakes are much lower, there's great debate. I loved it. Actually, and another thing, speaking of stuff that they do that's for everybody, you know, we talked about the music sometimes playing up the emotional aspects. Now I'm jumping way ahead to the last scene of the episode.
Jump away.
The music in general in this episode I thought was particularly good. When Jeff Breckenridge says to Josh to take the dollar out of his pocket and look at it.
Mm-hmm.
You got a dollar?
Yeah.
Take it out. Look at the back. The seal, the pyramid, it's unfinished. With the eye of God looking over it and the words Anuit Coeptis. He, God, favors our undertaking. The seal is meant to be unfinished because this country is meant to be unfinished. We're meant to keep doing better. We're meant to keep discussing and debating, and we're meant to read books by great historical scholars and then talk about them, which is why I lent my name to a dust cover.
That whole speech, it really moved me. And I don't know, this time it really it affected me a lot. I think maybe because of all the tumult and discord and horrible things that are happening around the world, but especially around the conventions. I don't know. I've been feeling kind of distraught about America in general. And that speech about we're meant to keep discussing and we're meant to keep debating, it really affected me.
Yeah, no, it spoke to me as well. And then just within the framework of the show itself, it was encouraging to me that an encounter like this ended, I don't want to say for the first time, but certainly it's been rare in the first season thus far, where an appointee or somebody that the White House senior staff has sort of some leverage over gets to walk away having convinced them, you know, let me be me.
Right.
That we've had so many opportunities and so many situations where they've really sort of tamped down their appointees, or, you know, O'Leary is made to apologize to Wooden and
Mendoza's told he can't ride out the, you know, whatever demonstration he wants to make.
Right. Political expediency is just again and again causing our guys to kind of tamp down the people that they've chosen, presumably because they trust their instincts and the way they want to conduct themselves. And at least this time, Breckenridge really makes the case, and they go and they have lunch, and we finally see like one of these guys who could have been kind of maybe pressured into, hey, you want this job? This is how you're going
to
do it.
Right. You have to disavow this thing that you said.
Right. But instead, he gets the go ahead, go be you.
Yeah. I love that Josh lost his cool during this debate, too. Jeff Breckenridge is so even keeled throughout it. He doesn't get mad. He's talking about it intelligently, and he doesn't get steamed up the way that Josh does. And it's interesting how well that those layers start to get built up of Josh's frustration over the conversation.
While we're on the subject of the Civil War, let's remember the 600,000 white men who died over the issue of slavery.
Is that why they died?
It's why a lot of them died, Jeff. And there's no other place in time in recorded history where an event like that has occurred. So let's just leave it at that and move on, okay?
Jeff, I would love to give you the money. I really would, but I'm a little short on cash right now. You see, the SS officer forgot to give my grandfather his wallet back when he let him out of Birkenau.
Well, your beef's with the Germans.
You're damn right it is.
Yeah, yeah, it's handled well. It's acted well by both of them, Brad and Carl Lumbly as Breckinridge. He's also one of those guys who's done, I think, really just hundreds of episodes of TV and who's always good.
He's so great in this.
I certainly know him from many, many, many episodes of Alias.
You know what made me laugh? When Sam is talking to Mallory, when she first confronts him about the position paper, she says,
"Don't play dumb with me."
No, honestly, I am dumb. Most of the time, I'm playing smart.
I wrote down, "Hey, it's us."
That's funny. I have similar thoughts all the time. it's very well put. That did make me laugh out loud. We get more of a very charismatic, funny, lovable Sam Seaborn.
They've really made the character evolve into somebody who I love.
Yeah. And on the voucher side of things too, you can certainly question the fact that he could have allayed her fear with before she even fully expressed her concern at having read his position paper. He could have said, "This is just opposition prep." I mean, he really plays it out, but it does allow Aaron to write kind of both sides of an argument articulately, even though he puts them in the same actor's mouth, which is actually interesting. But I like when he, even when it's sort of clear where Sam and where the writer who's writing for him ultimately comes down on the issue, he wrote both sides convincingly and well.
I watched it twice before we talked, and the second time I was specifically looking for how he deals with not coming clean about what his actual position is. And there are at least a couple moments where it seems like he is about to tell her that this is just a thing that I had to do for my job. And both times, or each time, she cuts him off and says something especially inflammatory. And then he feels like he has to just defend himself, and it gets sidetracked, and he never gets to have that moment where he says, "Oh, this was something I had to do for, I had to take the opposite side."
I thought we had something going on,
Sam. We do.
And yet you haven't told me that you favor school vouchers.
First of all, hang on. We haven't been on a date yet.
Yeah. I like it. It's also, I think, edifying in a sense as to his character and really to all of them that they like intellectual repartee and battle. Arguing for sport is something that's part of their daily job and they relish it.
Yeah. As much as they make out that Leo is trying to separate the two of them or drive a wedge between them, Leo does say,
"When we're gearing up for a debate, we have the smart guys take the other side."
Right.
He says it in a very, unceremonious way, which in some ways makes it even have even more impact that Sam is the smart guy.
Is it time to talk about the jackal?
No, wait, not yet. Because
we need to build up to it?
Yeah. Because I still have one more thing about this, which is in terms of Leo driving a wedge between them, how many subplots can you have about characters dating their boss's daughter in such a small cast?
Several.
Apparently more than one. You'd think that one would be all you could really get away with. And I would argue that that's true. That is all you can get away with.
So which one do you accept? Charlie Zoe?
Yeah, the Charlie Zoe one. As we've noted before, that relationship is a lot more mature. And clearly the stakes are much higher there. There are realities of race and racism in America, while also getting all the like fun, lovable moments of two characters with a lot of charisma interacting with each other.
Right. Well, leave it to those two kids. They've managed to get a lot farther in their relationship than Mallory and Sam have, who I think by the end of this episode still haven't, that we're particularly aware of, gone on their first date. I guess we see them leave for lunch, but that's about it. Whereas Charlie and Zoe are already snogging in the hallway.
Yeah. A really weird kiss.
And now we're going to take a quick break to thank our sponsors.
Support for The West Wing Weekly is brought to you by Poopery,
the before-you-go toilet spray that traps bathroom odor beneath the surface of the water.
Yes, it's a real product. And yes, it really works.
And yes, you will leave the toilet smelling better than you found it every time you go.
After all, that would be the politically correct thing to do. And the politically correct thing to do.
So visit poopery.com. That's POOPOURRI.com. And then enter West Wing, no spaces, during checkout, and you'll get 20% off.
The West Wing Weekly is sponsored by Texture.
Texture has completely reimagined magazines, giving you the articles and stories you really want all in one place, plus interactive features, videos, and recommendations just for you.
Sign up right now at texture.com/westwing, and you'll get insider access to all the content from the world's best publications.
And here's the best part. Texture is offering our listeners a free trial right now when you go to texture.com/westwing.
You get immediate entry to all the top magazines, including titles like Billboard and Better Home and Gardens, Bon Appetit, Entertainment Weekly, Cosmopolitan, Rolling Stone, and a lot more.
And you get back issues and bonus video content, all of it in the palm of your hand. So start binge reading for free right now when you go to texture.com/westwing.
And now back to the show. Okay, The Jackal.
Here we go. Did you have to watch horror movie like through a hand across your face? Or is that just me?
Yeah. I mean, there's no suspense because I've seen it so many times. I know where all the scary parts are, so I don't have to cover my eyes.
I want to say this, just overall. For me, it's the whitest scene ever filmed since the signing of the Declaration in the film 1776.
I don't understand. There's so much I don't understand about what's going on.
It's certainly the gift of Jif.
Yes.
I mean, I know we can get some Rob Lowe up there. I think we can get Brad Whitford and his white man's overbite. Hats off to Allison herself. I enjoy her Jackal rendition. The surrounding white men and their attempt to sort of groove along. Kind of hard to watch.
Really, it's Sam and Josh.
Yeah.
They are the worst offenders, I think.
Certainly.
But I was always so confused just about the fact of it. It's built up so much before we actually even see it. Oh, she's going to do the Jackal. She's going to do the Jackal. And I didn't know what the Jackal was. Like, this was not a song I'd ever heard in my life.
Nor I. Nor since.
Right. In any other context. I actually talked to Anne Klein, the music supervisor for The West Wing, about getting that song on the show.
PhD in Street Stride. They called him the Jackal.
I'm Anne Klein, the music supervisor from The West Wing.
And what does a music supervisor do?
So basically, the music supervisor deals with all the music issues in the production. So whether it's helping to find a composer, doing deals, finding music that plays in the background of scenes, hiring artists to perform on camera, just any issue that involves music falls under our domain. The West Wing was probably 50-50. There was so much that Aaron knew he wanted and would write into scripts, or he would see something that would inspire him, or he'd write to a song. So a lot of it was just helping him get what he wanted. And then there would definitely be times as well where we'd all work together to collaborate to figure out what made sense for a scene or a storyline or whatever it was.
We're about to talk about episode 18, which is in some people's minds probably most notable for The Jackal.
Yeah.
So what was your experience of working on that episode and with that music cue specifically?
I knew I'd heard about that Allison Janney had done this in her trailer, and then they said that they were going to put it in an episode and asked me to clear it. And I'd never heard the song, and I'd never seen her do it. And back then, it wasn't so easy always to find the rights to songs or figure out, you know, what the song was and who owned the rights. But luckily, there's not a ton of songs named The Jackal. But I know we didn't have a lot of time. It was kind of like, this is going to happen, and it's the whole scene, so it has to work out, basically. And I remember being super nervous about it, but it was a pretty quick clearance. And then it was awesome to go down to set and watch her perform it. But that just came from her knowing this song, and everyone loved it.
It's kind of a random song, right?
Yes. I mean, had you heard of it before?
No, I never had. And But the way it was presented on the show, I felt like I ought to have.
Right, me too. And I feel like when things like that happen, and they're, you know, and whoever, I don't know who came and told me about it. It might have been Tommy. They were like, this thing she does is amazing, the jackal. And I was, you know, and you're almost embarrassed. You're like, I don't know what the jackal is, but I'm about to find out.
Right. And then it's like, music is my job.
I should definitely know this, but never heard of it.
Well, that makes me feel better about not knowing it myself. Thank you so much.
Thanks. It was really nice meeting you, and I love your podcast.
Oh, thanks a lot.
Okay, take care. When they called him
the jackal. So if Anne Klein doesn't know about what the song is and she's a music supervisor, I don't feel so bad.
No, so you, at your behest, actually, I reached out to Aaron Sorkin.
Oh, yeah, because I saw this note that said that this is something that Allison really did, but when it came time to actually film the scene, she was too good at it, and Aaron asked her to make it more awkward.
Right, so you gave me that quote. I'm not sure where you found it. Do you remember?
It was on Wikipedia.
Oh, in Wikipedia it says, Janney's performance of the Jackal was deemed too good by Sorkin during initial production, and she was advised to make it more awkward to fit the character for the final screen version. So I sent this to Aaron and said, can you confirm, deny, any further comment? And he said it wasn't Allison, it was the director. I can't remember who directed the episode. It's in fact Clark Johnson. Apologies to Clark. But he originally staged the Jackal as if he were doing a musical number on the show that had been rehearsed. When I came to watch the first setup, I saw that it looked like a Vegas act and explained that it was just meant to be someone lip-syncing late at night while the staff stood around and watched. It didn't have anything to do with the character being awkward. It had everything to do with our show not being a musical. As you know, The West Wing frequently shot late on Friday nights and well into Saturday mornings. Fratterday, we called them. And on Friday nights, Allison's trailer, which had been dubbed Cafe Flamingo after CJ's Secret Service codename, became a hangout where cast and crew could get a cocktail during lighting setups. On one such Friday night, I was in my office trying to start writing the next script. I was stuck and took a walk over to Cafe Flamingo. I walked in and Allison was doing the Jackal while Richard tugged on a cigar in the corner. I waited until she was done and then I went back to my office and wrote the teaser for 6 meetings before lunch.
Ha!
Interesting, right? Great response.
Yeah.
One, to me, the big revelation is apparently they would drink and then film.
Right.
Just strikes me as shockingly unprofessional. I've done it myself, but only where I'm when I'm supposed to be drunk on screen. But apparently that was okay back in the 90s and the early aughts.
You didn't do that on Fratterdays when you were on the West Wing?
No. Not that I recall. I don't think so. I mean, I certainly, I've been to Cafe Flamingo.
Oh, you have? Okay, you knew that term.
Yeah, but I want to say, maybe I'm just protecting my own ass here. I don't think I ever drank before I was done shooting, possibly after. So let me also first say, so not to cast anything negative on Clark Johnson, these things sometimes happen. Usually in pre-production, there will be what are called tone meetings. And I've never attended one myself because I've never directed an episode of TV. But in each scene and beat of a scene will get discussed in terms of what the writer, you know, in TV, the writer is the ultimate creative person. And so you want to get what he or she wants on screen. So there will be called, what's a tone meeting? What's the tone of this? And, you know, who knows? Sometimes things don't get discussed at as great length as they ought to. And maybe there was a miscommunication of sort where it seemed like this was more supposed to be like a number from Glee than from The West Wing. I have to say, Aaron's email leaves me wanting to see the first take of this scene.
Right.
I want to see what it meant with the more polished, rehearsed, Vegas-y version of the scene.
Yeah. One thing I was thinking about when you were talking about Sam and how much these characters love intellectual debate and just are great at what they do. They give that same kind of characteristic to the Secret Service. I feel like Gina says to CJ, I'm looking at teenage Nazis. And she's like, why? And she's like, I'm on a break. That even when she's not working, she just loves what she does so much. It was nice that passion extends outside of just the senior staff.
Yeah, you're right. That's a very good point. That's an Aaron Sorkin workplace, whether it's a sports show or a newsroom or a sketch comedy show or here at the White House, people come to work to do their best, generally for the right reasons. They're super dedicated. They're good at what they do. They don't loaf. They don't drink during lighting setups. Oh, I mean, the cast playing them does, but not the characters.
I really liked the CJ and Gina scene.
I did too.
It's a short scene, and a lot of the information that we get is stuff that has already been covered in that scene with Gina and the president on Air Force One, where they talk about how she can't disclose information about her protectee. But there's something about their dynamic that's so interesting.
Gina, I'm the press secretary. There's a story that Zoe's involved with, and I need you to tell me what you know about last night.
I'm sorry, CJ. I can't protect her if she feels like she's got to do things behind my back. I'm not permitted to discuss the behavior of the protectee.
Okay. Thanks.
CJ, the thing with the reporter this morning, it was fast, it was physical. She's 19 years old, and she thought her father was in trouble.
Okay, thanks. I appreciate it. Sorry about
No problem.
I loved it.
I thought the same thing, too. It definitely caught my eye, and my takeaway, I hope this won't come out the wrong way, it struck me as a classically female interaction. I don't paint with too broad a brush, but let's say that any other two male characters from this show had had that interaction, it probably would have left with hurt feelings, and you know, the press secretary would have been pissed off because this Secret Service agent wouldn't give him what he wanted. There's something to me, there's sort of like, this is a better approach to things, where they're kind of circling each other. They're kind of staking out their territory, and they're making clear where the line is drawn, but they're also finding a little way to compromise. And then the scene ends, and they haven't alienated each other. They have a greater understanding of each other. And it even ends with her saying, hey, do you want to hang out with me during my break?
Right.
It's just like there's something.
It's the most minor of power struggles.
Right, exactly. We're not every little thing doesn't have to get blown up into a destructive moment.
Right. It's the kind of the very opposite of what happens with Josh and Jeff Breckenridge, where they are talking about something and Josh is like, oh, let's talk about it in the abstract. Jeff Breckenridge says, no, this is a real thing. But even as Josh talks about it in whatever abstract terms he frames it, he still gets so heated about it, as if he's being personally attacked. He gets so defensive about the idea of reparations, even academically.
Yeah, and Toby Ziegler screams all the time at the slightest.
Right. His arc in this episode is fantastic. The shortest good mood ever.
Yes. I do like that opening sequence, though, where he's actually calling people by name.
Right.
And he's smiling, and he actually chuckles, and it mainly gets bemused or nonplussed looks from the rest of the staff. This right. is not the Toby they're used to.
You got 2 seconds?
Madeline, you are charming and you are brilliant, and for you I have all the time in the world.
What's with him?
It's the day after his day of jubilee.
He never sustains a good mood this long.
Bonnie, you are dedicated and you are beautiful. And Ginger, you are other nice things.
You know, he tells Mandy that he needs to snap out of his good mood, and she starts to tell him about the need for the pandas. And the whole time while he's doing that, he's sitting there, he's twiddling his thumbs.
Oh, is he literally?
He's literally twiddling his thumbs. And I love that as he goes from his strange happy mood to his mood being completely deflated, and he lets her know, well, that did the trick. He doesn't stop. Like, his body language doesn't actually change. His posture is the same. His little absent-minded twiddling of the thumbs is exactly the same. You only find out that things have changed by his voice and what he says.
I felt bad for Mandy / Moira in this episode.
You know, one thing that we didn't talk about, actually, Josh, is that this is episode 18. In episodes 16 and 17, there was no Mandy. She didn't appear in 2 episodes.
Yeah, you said we should discuss that. I know you shot me an email saying, hey, we should have mentioned that. When I read your email, I hadn't noticed that she wasn't there in those 2 episodes.
Right.
Judging from the amount of email and comments I've seen from people, it's one of the great enigmas of the show as to what actually happened. You know, we've got some theories, and Donna and Josh were really, their chemistry was sizzling in a way that Mandy and Josh's wasn't, and that she's a little bit of the outsider, and that she's so focused on optics. But again, in the end, I do find myself puzzled as to, I want to know the what really happened of it all. I don't know that we'll get to the bottom of it when we finally drag Aaron in here. I don't know if he'll want to address it on mic, but I am interested.
Yeah.
There's a story there that I don't think anybody has shared publicly.
I've even, you know, in a couple episodes, really tried to look for the best in Mandy and what the character was bringing, you know, try and find the goodness or something in that character, even though she is so universally disliked and pointed out, oh, she's, you know, she's doing the right thing here. She's actually the voice of reason here. But yeah, it's really telling that we went two episodes without her and we didn't even notice it.
Didn't see fit to comment on it.
Yeah.
Well, this episode, she's really given not much to work with. We've got a discussion about reparations happening, a discussion about school vouchers. There are issues of white supremacy and death threats. There's a question of how properly to deal with an overly aggressive press. And then there's Mandy talking about getting another panda
right.
from China.
And I would normally have no problem with that, even if there's like a part of the plot that's lighter. I'll tell you, there's one exact moment where I was like, this is where I found Mandy to be really awful in a way that I hadn't really felt since the first couple of episodes. She's talking about the pandas and she says,
it may have been Ping.
Whatever. Ping Orling dies, Sing Sing mourns. Panda bears, turns out, mourn. And for Sing Sing, it seemed like the time was unendurable.
And she chuckles while delivering that line. Panda bears, it turns out, mourn. And I was like, where's the humor in that? Where is, like...
Damn. Oh, you're tough. You really will not give her a break.
No.
Man, oh man. She thinks grief-stricken bears are funny.
Right. It's like, oh, look at that. They mate for life and then they get sad.
Maybe she's nervous because nobody likes her. There are two pandas in Gail's fishbowl this episode.
Very nice.
I didn't even have to look it up at that great site that lists everything that's in Gail's fishbowl. It's like, I caught it myself.
I love both Toby and Josh's utter lack of knowledge and disdain for panda bears. That Josh says,
little Australian thing eats the bark off the koala tree.
And Toby says, get us two regular bears.
Yeah, a bucket of black paint, a bucket of white paint.
Yeah. It's quite embarrassed of him.
This is true. You're not wrong.
To say that there are such a thing as regular bears and non-regular bears. But yeah, I wrote down, why chuckle about panda bears mourning? Arg.
Yeah, I guess so. That's bad. I didn't even pick up on it.
It was, for me, reminiscent of, like, that was the exact moment when I was like, I'm done with Mandy. Sort of like in The Simpsons when Ralph gives the Valentine to Lisa, and then later on when she rejects him, Bart is going through the tape and says,
watch this, Lise. You can actually pinpoint the second when his heart rips in half.
So Mandy's dead to you now.
I'm done with her. I like this George Washington book that the president's reading.
I didn't like, though, that it started with a big close-up of the perfectly legible title of the book, and then Charlie comes in and says, what you reading? I don't know. Like, we don't have to hear the title. We know. But I guess Charlie's not watching the show, so I withdraw the comment.
Okay. I really like the... I don't know that it's like a ha-ha moment, but I find it incredibly funny, cerebrally, this exchange when CJ comes in and President Bartlett reads to her the little passage from the thing. He says,
CJ!
Mr. President!
When in company, put not your hands to any part of the body not usually covered.
Well, I do what it takes to keep the press corps happy, Mr. President.
Yeah, you're right.
It's really not on the nose. It's like there, you have to think about it for a second.
Yeah, what was she thinking? No, it's very funny.
It's so good.
You're right. He's a good writer. That's Sorkin.
I love that. Yeah, you're right. But this is another great scene where CJ, having been bucked up by Sam, who tells her to stay in the president's face, she actually goes and she does it.
Right.
He's all riled up and he's ready to call the press into the briefing room. And CJ actually raises her voice. She yells at him.
You can't talk to the press.
Watch me.
I'm telling you now, Mr. President, this isn't about your daughter. It's about the first daughter, and that's my job, and you're not going down there. You, me, Charlie, and Zoe are the only four people who know she was lying, and there's no reason it doesn't need to stay that way. It's a non-story. You go down there, and it's a big story.
And there again is like a power struggle that she's thrust in the middle of. And it goes beautifully. Again, it gets resolved in this really nice way. She does what she's supposed to do.
Right.
She gets in his face and she talks him down.
It turns out Sam's advice to her was actually fairly sage advice.
Yeah.
It is what she needed to do. And she quits herself very well in that scene.
Yeah. And you get the full validation of it too. I think when the way that the president says thank you to her at the end, you know, like that she finishes yelling at him and then he says, thank you, CJ.
Right.
All in all, I really like this episode. Again, it's one of the small stakes ones, but I love these, the little moments, the daily life.
These are the ones that I tend to like more too. And that's it for this episode. I hope you'll join us next time. In the meantime, you can leave a comment, a question, or just your own particular take on why you don't like me at thewestwingweekly.com or on our Facebook page.
Facebook.com/thewestwingweekly.
As always, you can reach us on Twitter. Rishi is at Rishi Hirway. I'm at Josh Molina.
Ann Klein is at The Ann Klein.
And the show itself is at West Wing Weekly.
And if you want to get your own West Wing Weekly pin, you can go to thewestwingweekly.com/pin. Check them out. They're really pretty.
Oh, Rishi. I'm having a revelation. Two people run into each other and notice that they're each wearing a lapel pin. There should be something you do.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know what it is. We have to think about it. Maybe we'll come up with it for next time.
Turn around three times, spit and say poo-poo, yell flintel, and then run away.
Wow. That is a lot more elaborate than I was thinking, but sure. Okay. We'll see whether we get any reports of that.
But please, if you run into somebody with a West Wing Weekly lapel pin while you're wearing yours, take a picture, send it to us. It'd be great.
There you go.
Okay.
Okay.
What's next?